This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Dahlia Lithwick joins me live in studio. She's a senior editor at Slate.com and a columnist for Newsweek magazine. And you are just back from New York, is that right? Do I have that right?
That is right. I'm pretty much just off the plane.
So you're in New York City. They fly you up. Last night, folks may have seen you on the Colbert Show.
That's right.
So when did you find out, like, how does this work? When did you find out, and did somebody, like, call your home and say, we need you on Colbert?
It was a little bit like that. As soon as, you know, it became manifest late last. For people who don't know who I am, I cover the Supreme Court. I guess I should say that.
I should have said that. I'm sorry.
It's okay. So otherwise, why are they
calling
me?
You are one of the nation's preeminent experts on the Supreme Court and legal issues facing this country, and we are always honored to have you here.
Thank you.
You are the smartest woman that's ever been in this room, hands down.
So, yeah, I think it became clear at the end of last week that we were going to have what I'm calling the nerd Super Bowl, you know, that the Supreme Court was about to explode into the headlines. And I think when it's the nerd Super Bowl, I'm on speed dial. So yeah. I did get a call, I think Thursday or Friday of last week, saying, can you kind of be on standby if Obama picks someone to fill the John Paul Stevens seat at the court this week? And lo and behold, first thing Monday morning, we knew that was the case. So.
So what's it like to be on the Colbert Show? You get a lot of swag. You get, what's the green room like? What's the food like? What's he like?
It was all very, very nice. The green room is green. There's a little cheese plate and there's a fruit plate.
What do they serve? Is there booze in there?
There was not booze in there, although the bag of swag had a honking bottle of vodka that I could not bring back on the plane with me. I left it with my mother-in-law in her care and custody.
Enjoy.
Exactly. So there is some swag. It was very fun. And I have to say, you know, I do kind of a lot of TV, but I have never seen a staff like that. Every producer, every makeup person, every sound guy, they are so kind and so smart and so completely in love with Stephen Colbert. It was really interesting.
We're talking with Dahlia Lithwick, and the phone lines are open at 977-1070. Join us at any time. You were on Stephen Colbert last night, of course, for the same reason you're on this show today, and that is to talk about the appointment of Elena Kagan, as you call it, the nerd Super Bowl. Whenever a Supreme Court justice gets appointed, it's like Washington just stops. It instantly becomes the story, and it is the story for weeks, right? I mean, we just... Everybody tracks this thing because this appointment, if confirmed, this individual will have a dramatic impact on the future of this country. And this person, if confirmed, would have an impact for decades.
Well, that's right. I think the key thing, there are several key things to say about Elena Kagan. She is currently Barack Obama's Solicitor General. That means she is the government's lawyer at the Supreme Court, and she argues cases on behalf of the government and before the Supreme Court. Before that, she was dean of Harvard Law School, and we can talk about why that's significant in a minute. What she isn't is a federal judge. This is the first nomination in almost 40 years since Nixon tapped Lewis Powell and William Rehnquist to the court that we have a non-judge being put up for a nomination. And that's really interesting in all sorts of ways. It's already caused enormous blowback among Republicans who are saying she has no judicial experience to speak of, and this is impossible and impermissible. How can she possibly be a judge? But it's certainly a very interesting situation after four decades of exclusively judges to put up someone who comes to the court via a different route.
Yeah. So we're talking with Dahlia Lithwick. So why her? Why did the folks in the White House, you know, when it came time for a decision, why her? What is it about her that he recognized? Not only are you qualified to serve on the Supreme Court, I believe you can get confirmed as well.
I think there's a couple of good answers to that question. By the end of last week, we knew there were four people on Obama's shortlist. It was widely disseminated that he had winnowed this 10-person shortlist down to four. It's not an accident that Kagan is right in the middle of that shortlist in terms of ideology. In other words, there was people on the list who were to her left. There were people on the list to her right. He picked the middle person, and I think that speaks volumes about Obama right there.
Well, I saw you at Saturday at the pool, and you said, I think it's going to be Kagan.
Yeah, I think it was fairly evident. I mean, I should say, to be clear, I think it's been evident all along. There's a reason he put her in the Solicitor General spot a year and a half ago, and it's because he was teeing up this nomination. So I don't think anyone was hugely surprised. I think that there is something about Elena Kagan that really speaks to Obama's own view of what jurisprudence should be. And to understand that, you need to see what she did at Harvard Law School when she was the dean. She's only 50, I should add. She's extremely young. And when she went to Harvard, it was in utter disarray. The finances were in disarray. The faculty were at each other's throats. The students were miserable. It was a horrible place to be. And she turned it around. And she turned it around in several really critical ways. First of all, she just ran the most unbelievable fundraising campaign in the history of law school. She hired a bunch of, at the time, very controversial faculty members who were conservatives, notably Jack Goldsmith, who came out of the Bush administration, out of the Office of Legal Counsel, and had certainly his fingerprints around some of the Bush doctrines that were really questionable at the time. She reached across the aisle and made conservatives feel comfortable in all sorts of ways at a school that had tilted ideologically so far to the left that I think it felt unbalanced. And anybody you talk to says she just changed everything. And she did it by listening. She did it by reframing so that people felt included and understood. She has this, tell me when it starts to sound like Obama, this magical way of bringing people that are very polarized together around the center, helping them understand they're not as far apart as they seem. So you can start to see why for Obama, this is such an attractive choice for the court that is utterly polarized, worse than it's been in a long, long time, probably in decades. I think he has some hope that she's going to have the ability to build bridges on the court the same way she did at Harvard.
Interesting. In a way that perhaps O'Connor may have? Or am I stretching things there? Because I know she was a swing vote there.
She was a swing vote. I think that O'Connor's great gift was that she came up through the Arizona legislature. And so she did have, and I think this is what you're flicking at, these same political skills that Kagan had, the ability to broker deals, the ability to compromise. She wasn't such a firm ideologue that she couldn't, at the end of the day, get five votes by hook or by crook. And I think that is a quality that Kagan has. I think the difference is, O'Connor, Senator Day O'Connor was very certain of her views, of her jurisprudence. And because she was the swing vote, she sort of put her thumbprint on every piece of major legal doctrine that came along in the last couple of years. Kagan isn't that. Kagan is not in any way certain, or at least you can't tell from looking at her writing that she has this sweeping ideological view of the legal landscape. She's not that person. She looks to be a problem solver and a fixer. She looks to be somebody who, if you look at her legal writings, likes to say, hey, let's look at all of First Amendment law and see if we can mash it into a new framework and make it all make sense.
So if she does get confirmed, we're talking with Dahlia Lithwick, if she does get confirmed and she's on the court, you can only imagine that what a choice office to clerk in, because you really can have an impact. I mean, this sounds like somebody who would be very much open to her clerks and ideas and input. She's not like a Scalia who walks into a meeting long since having made up his mind.
I don't think so. And in fact, her students, I've been getting a lot of email from former students of hers, both at Chicago Law School and at Harvard. They revere her. I mean, they say this is a person who pushes, sometimes to the point that you're ready to wet your pants. But she really forces you to think independently and forces herself to do that. If you read her scholarship, which I've started to do, she's meticulous about saying, I'm going to credit the right with this argument, I'm going to credit the left with this argument. So I think it's very apt to say she's not a Scalia. She's somebody who just is trying to find a middle way. Now, I want to be very clear, she will be replacing John Paul Stevens. That's the fourth liberal on a liberal court. So we're not looking at a seismic change in the balance of the court. We still have a starkly polarized, four conservatives, four liberals, and Anthony Kennedy somewhere in the middle, although more and more throwing his weight in with the conservatives. So I think it's a little bit probably optimistic or pessimistic, depending on your political viewpoint, to think that she's going to massively influence the conservative bloc at the court. It's very entrenched right now. I think one of the things Obama is trying to do is signal that this is a vote for civility. It's a vote for opening up the lines of communication. And because she could be on the court for 30, 40 years, a hope that the court in future is going to be a lot less rigid than it is right now.
We're talking with Dahlia Lithwick of Slate and Newsweek. The phone lines are open, 977-1070. Do you support the nominee? That's a question for you, 977-1070. I want to, before we talk about the politics of this, after, you know, we've been introduced to who she is, before we look at the politics and the political theater of the confirmation process, I think it's important to note that when Obama was running, the right was just screaming that this is the most liberal senator that's ever been in the U.S. Senate, and this is a raging liberal. But again, I've said this before, you don't see that in his actions. He did not appoint a raging liberal to the Supreme Court. I mean, this is a solid political moderate.
Last night on the best seat.
I think that's absolutely right, and I think that he, in some sense, appointed someone in his own image, not just a moderate, but somebody who foundationally believes in communication and in trying to reconcile opposing parties. So I think you're quite right. There were certainly a contingent of people, a very vocal contingent of people, and I'll confess to being one of them, who said, look, we have four very strong conservatives on the court and three moderate technocrats that sort of purport to be the liberals.
Where's the left-wing Scalia?
Where's the left Scalia? Where's the left Alito? Where's the left Clarence Thomas, John Roberts? And so there was a real clamor when Obama had this opening that said, this is the last time he's going to have this many votes in the Senate. Put up someone now that you can clear, save a Kagan for later when she will get confirmed. But he didn't do that. And I think it really bespeaks a vision of the court, a vision of the judicial branch in general, that we're not used to in this country. We're used to presidents saying, I am going to remake the court in my image. And then that image is extremely ideological. This is Obama saying, I'm going to remake the court in my image. But it's not a far left nomination.
He's not ideological.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's a point that's, I guess, missed on the Tea Party folks, that as much as they insist that he's a raging liberal, nothing he does really shows that.
I think that's right. And you're seeing already some of the GOP criticism, the harsh criticism of Elena Kagan tracks that. But they're really reaching. One of the things that they've picked up on that they're trying to use against her is her college thesis, where she talks about the death of socialism as if to say, you know, that somehow determines that she's a socialist. They've picked a filament of a speech that she gave in tribute to Thurgood Marshall, who she clerked for, and he was a lifelong mentor. And in the speech about Marshall, she quoted him saying that the Constitution is a, quote, defective document. Why? Because it made Thurgood Marshall three-fifths of a man under the original framers' construction of it. And she said, with some, I think, approval, he thought it was a defective document. It was. Well, you pull that out of context, and all of a sudden you've got Elena Kagan thinks the framers were defective. So there is the same effort to portray her as a left-wing wingnut bananas,
yeah,
raging socialist. But I think that those examples suggest that it's a grasping at straws.
We're talking with Dahlia Lithwick about the appointment of Elena Kagan, and the phone lines are open for you. Let's bring the listeners in on the conversation. Ted is in Charlottesville. Ted, you're on the program. Go right ahead.
I have a question for Dahlia. If Kagan is this wonderful, why was Sotomayor picked over her for the first position?
That's a great question, Ted. I think the answer is that Obama felt very, very strongly that he wanted to make a historic pick for his first choice, and he wanted it to be the first Hispanic on the court. I think he felt that the country needed that. And I think that he also felt that Kagan wasn't quite ready, and that's one of the reasons he put her in the Solicitor General slot, gave her a year of arguing at the court, sort of gave her a sense that she was being seasoned in the Washington establishment, because otherwise he would have really plucked her right out of Harvard and it would have looked like a stretch. So I think he was timing it, in his view, exactly right, which is do this historic, epic pick and put the Hispanic woman on the court first, and give Kagan a little time to kind of marinate in the juices of Washington, D.C., the juices of the Supreme Court, and then a year later bring her up.
And it also gives an opportunity for the sitting justices to get to know her.
To get to know Kagan.
Kagan, yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's important to say Kagan is not a Washington outsider. She worked in the Clinton administration. She had been put up by Clinton in 1999 for a federal judgeship. It never came to a vote in the Senate. That never happened. So it's not as though nobody knew who she was. Certainly they all have a sense of her. And when you watch her argue at the court, you see there's a real collegiality there. But I think it is definitely true that what he wanted to do was put her in front of the court and see how it went. So I think that he's very conscious of wanting to. When he inherited his office, there was one woman on the court. I think it's terrifically important to him to have three women on the court. We can talk about whether those demographics matter. It's also worth just pointing out with Kagan's appointment and Stevens' departure from the court, for the first time in history, there is no Protestant on the U.S. Supreme Court.
No Protestant.
No Protestant. In a country that is over 50% Protestant, we have 6 Catholics and 3 Jews, if Kagan is confirmed. And that's a fascinating demographic shift at the court.
We're talking with Dahlia Lithwick. Ted, thank you so much for the call. We're going to go to Eric. He's in Charlottesville. Eric, welcome to the program. Go right ahead.
Well, I just don't think it's true to suggest that the president isn't ideological. When he was a state senator in Illinois, when he was a U.S. senator, he also gave an interview to NPR where he gave a very clear outline of what he thought was wrong with the Supreme Court and wrong with the Constitution. And in this interview, he basically stated that the problem with the Constitution and what the court had ruled on previously was that the Constitution was a charter of negative liberties. In other words, it basically only talked about what the government could not do to the citizens and not a charter of what he called positive liberties, which basically is European-style socialism where the government is guaranteeing every citizen cradle-to-grave care. So he said that the court previously had failed to embrace, essentially, the kind of government that he thought we needed, which was one that recognized these alleged positive liberties. And so he was pretty open about what he thought the court should look like and what it should do. And Elena Kagan did, in fact, give a speech where she talked about something called redistribution of speech, where basically she claimed that if some points of view were overrepresented, then perhaps the court could rule in such a way to force other points of view to be represented more. It was a very strange speech, but it certainly was ideological. And to claim that both the president and his nominee don't have a particular ideology is just to simply ignore the public record.
Eric, thank you for the call. It's an excellent point, and I'll let you respond to that. But I just want to say, I mean, the complaint, the observation about the Constitution, Thomas Jefferson had the exact same complaint that, you know, when he first saw it, he said that you're not spelling out exactly what are the liberties of a citizen that exist prior to the creation of the government that are, you know, naturally endowed upon birth, and those need to be spelled out. So I don't see that as being ideological to be able to criticize the Constitution in that way.
Well, and I would build upon that a little bit. I think Eric does make a really good point, but I think that the things that Obama said before he became president are profoundly different from the way he has governed. I think Obama said a lot of things before he became president, notably about the Constitution and the war on terror, that as soon as he started getting those daily briefings, he pretty much scuttled. You know, he was going to close Guantanamo. There was going to be no state secrets document. There was going to be no holding people without due process. All of that is gone. It's what people call Bush Light, and it's what progressives are infuriated with about Obama, that he doesn't govern from the far left. Even no matter what he said when he was running for office, when he governs, he's very much governed or tried to govern, not just from the center, but from a place of pragmatism over ideology. And I think that, again, Elena Kagan has given speeches, she's written papers, but I think that if you look at the aggregate of her work, you're going to find it very, very hard. It's one of the things that terrifies liberals to say that this is a person person with a strong ideological bent. She's not, if you look at her, most of her writings, they're not normative writings. They're not prescriptive writings where she says the government should X, Y, Z. They're almost completely descriptive and very theoretical. She is not somebody who wants to change the world. She's someone who wants to describe it.
Let's go. Robert is in Crozet. Robert, I got time for one quick question. Go right ahead.
Well, the suggestion by Dahlia that there's no left-wing version of Scalia, I mean, all you have to do is go to that Coelho decision. There are four or five left-wingers that pretty much say that your property can belong to another private individual. That's all right. I mean, so another private person could take your property. I mean, how can you get more left than what's already on the court? Scalia obviously didn't agree with, you know, the government taking your property to give to another private person. And, you know, I don't think that's right wing.
Robert, thanks for that. It's Kelo, right?
It's Kelo. That's the Connecticut takings case. And I think you're certainly going to find cases in which the four liberals on the court agree on things that are liberal principles. But I think doctrinally, if you look at them point for point, these are not people who are in any way comparable to Thurgood Marshall or to William Brennan, the liberals that came before them. These are very, very, very far to the right of what used to be the left wing of the court. So there's all sorts of good empirical data that shows, I don't think this is in dispute, that every single person who has been replaced at the court in the last several decades has been replaced by someone quite significantly to their right, possibly with the exception of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who I think was about a wash. But the court has moved quite remarkably to the right, and there's no evidence that the left wing of the court has moved anywhere close to further left.
Yeah, it makes you wonder if the decisions that were made under the Warren Court would be even possible today. I mean, these civil rights decisions I'm thinking of that instantly come to mind wouldn't have been possible under this court.
Well, and one of the most, I think Eric flicked at this point, and it's so important, Obama has said that he disavows the kind of what he calls activism of a Brennan and a Marshall. He says there was a time and a place for that. This is not the time or the place for that. I am not for that kind of liberalism. So I think just to close the circle, it's a really interesting thing when the president himself says, I want nothing to do with creating or trying to recreate that kind of court. The thing Obama hates the most from the right or the left is judicial activism. And he's been very, very clear that he doesn't like it any more when it comes from the court's liberal wing than when it comes from the right wing.
Dahlia Lithwick, she's a senior editor at Slate.com and a columnist for Newsweek. You can read her work online and in the Newsweek magazine. And I cannot thank you enough. I know you've been beyond busy, and you probably haven't slept in a few days, and I want to thank you so much for spending some time with us.
It's always a pleasure, Coy. Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit cvillepodcast.com for more.